There's a lot of miserable billionaires out there. Figuring out how to live life is in a way that is actually fulfilling, that is meaningful, I think, is the thing that a lot of Bitcoiners pursue, and which is why so many of them are getting married, are having kids, are going to church again, and that's a great thing.
This week, we are taking a dive into the evolution of global Bitcoin adoption and the morality of money with longtime legend in the Bitcoin space, Jimmy Song. Over the last 14 years, Jimmy has been a Bitcoin programmer, an author, university lecturer, and global public speaker on the subject. Someone who understands Bitcoin very deeply from a technical standpoint, as well as social and economic. I'm Scott Dietles. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how we'll help them. Jimmy's somebody who has been thinking about and working on Bitcoin for a very long time. Today's conversation has a wide variety of questions around subjects he's passionate about and has some insight on. Hope you enjoy. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week, we are joined by a very special guest, a longtime Bitcoin legend in the space, Jimmy Song. Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
So you're a first-time guest on the Block Reward, and maybe for the benefit of our listeners, we could just start with a little bit of an introduction to yourself. You've been in the space almost since the very beginning.
Not quite that long, but yeah, I've been around for a while. I started in 2011. I saw a story on Slashdot that said Bitcoin, internet-only currency Bitcoin reaches dollar parity, and I didn't know what it was, so I looked into it, and that's the first I heard of it. Started developing and contributing to open source projects based on Bitcoin starting in 2013. I wrote several books starting in 2017, and yeah, the latest one is here, Fiat Ruins Everything. That's book number 5 for me, all of them related to Bitcoin, so... Yeah, that's, and you know, I've taught a bunch of classes. I speak at a lot of conferences. I've done a bunch of things.
You have a podcast of your own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't recorded in a little bit, but that's because I have to go do some coding before I can go back to it. But yeah, I have a podcast, Bitcoin Fixes This, and I have a newsletter, Bitcoin Tech Talk. There's a bunch of stuff I do. I forget what I do sometimes just because there's lots of little things and not one big thing, which is what most people do, right? Like they have like one big job. I don't have a job, but I have like 8 different little things.
And I probably didn't imagine yourself being an author when this all started, but Bitcoin has a way of exposing people to things that they maybe didn't think they would do. That's a common story, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point because I think what people think of when they get into Bitcoin is that it's like any other track. But once you get into it, you realize it's not your traditional track and you can kind of just do things, right? That's like a meme going around on Noster is, you can just go do stuff. And that's massively freeing because I didn't think I was going to be an author, but that's something that just sort of fell in my lap and I tried it and it turned out to be great. I didn't think I'd be teaching either. But that turned out to be something that people wanted, and that's what I did. I've been an expert witness, for example. That's not something I imagined I'd be doing either. I've been speaking at conferences and stuff like that. Like none of this stuff was at all on my radar, but that's why I wear that cowboy hat. It's like kind of going out west and seeing what's out there and you find that there's a lot of opportunity.
Totally. Very cool. So I imagine, I was thinking, we know the narrative around Bitcoin has evolved a lot since 2011. We're at a very interesting time in the evolution of the Bitcoin narrative in Q1, Q2 of 2025. What are your sort of observations as a launch point of, you mentioned dollar parity being sort of an important moment that originally caught your attention, digital gold, we're kind of in this, is the IMF going to start thinking about Bitcoin as an asset? How have you observed this evolution over the last 14 years? And are you surprised at, what are you most surprised about?
Yeah, I mean, it really started as sort of like a darknet money, right? If you look at the history of Bitcoin, like the thing that put it on the map was WikiLeaks. And if you remember, this was when Julian Assange was collecting donations through PayPal, and PayPal basically cut off his account. And then he was like, okay, well, we got to find some other way to take donations because, we can't run. And at that point, Bitcoin was under a dollar. And Satoshi specifically said on the Bitcoin Talk forums, you know, we're too young of a currency to handle this. Please don't do this. And they did it anyway. And then he famously said that the swarm is headed towards us. Right. And for that time period, it was really more of a darknet currency. Soon afterwards, I think Silk Road started and things like that. And that was what it was known for. And the narrative really lasted up until 2013. And it was really the arrest of Ross Ulbricht, who was pardoned recently, which I'm very happy about, that really sort of put to bed that narrative that it's a darknet illegal money. And if you remember back then, you know, that was the major narrative. That was what everyone was saying was the purpose of Bitcoin. And that's what was on all the magazine covers and so on. And it wasn't until that event happened, and it's kind of surprisingly, right? Like I had friends in 2013 that were like, "Hey, I'm selling a significant chunk of my stuff because Ross Ulbricht was arrested." But the 6 weeks after that, I think he was arrested on October 1st, 2013. And then by middle of November 2013, like it went from $100 to $1,100. It was one of the greatest bull runs we ever saw. I guess maybe the 2011 one was a little bit bigger, but that was crazy. And everyone was like, wait, it's not darknet money. There's something else about this. And that narrative started to shift. And I don't think it was really fully articulated until 2017, 2018, when the Bitcoin Standard came out. And Safe Dean really made that argument that this isn't just something for spending or for illegal drugs or something like that. This is actually a better money in a very economic sense, in a very real sense. And that's been the narrative, I think, more or less since then. And there have been various offshoots of that, people trying to make it more of a medium of exchange. We had the block size wars in 2017. We even still have like a lot of people like sort of trying to bully people into spending more of their Bitcoin and so on. But I mean, I think if you study money, what you find is that people first use it as a savings vehicle. And then only when that becomes so prominent, like, you know, as a merchant, you stop taking other forms of payment, does it really become a method of payment? And then after that, it becomes a unit of account fairly quickly because everyone's sort of measuring in that. We're not quite there yet, but that's where I see the current moment, is that we're on our way to becoming that dominant currency. And that's going to take some time because the US dollar is extremely dominant. And there's lots of other countries that have their own fiat currency that have some motive in, you know, being able to steal from other people and so on.
So if you think about your own sort of personal evolution of the understanding of the narrative from the time you came on as a programmer to then right around when the Bitcoin Standard was when you started writing your own books, were there some like flashbulb moments or things that really changed your own perspective? And is this the reason you started writing books? So like, what could you share about that journey?
Yeah, I would say the major light bulb moments was the reaction to the Ross Ulbricht arrest. And that to me indicated, okay, this is way more than just a darknet currency. I mean, darknet currency is cool. I think there's definitely utility for, you know, money that can't be seized by the government, that like where you can transact without anyone knowing. And that's a significant part of the cypherpunk ethos. But I think the real like understanding of that really came with the Bitcoin Standard. And I was fortunate enough to know Safe before he published that. So he had me review some of the entire book that he had written up to that point and 2016, I think it was. And, you know, we didn't even know each other that well, but I gave him so many comments because I knew that this would be a blockbuster. I like when I was reading it, I was like, this is the economic understanding that I needed. And it articulated it very well. And at that point, I was like, yeah, this is why Bitcoin is succeeding the way it has, and not because of all these other narratives and so on. So that was a big one. Now, why I started writing books was because I was getting frustrated that the resources that I wanted weren't there. So my first book is Programming Bitcoin, and that's specifically for developers that wanted to understand the Bitcoin protocol. And at the time I wrote it, I had worked for three different Bitcoin companies between 2014 and 2017. And, you know, one of the frustrations was I'd get into the company and we'd hire somebody and they wouldn't know what to do, right? Like they didn't understand Bitcoin at all. So I would have to spend some time teaching them, you know, the basics of stuff. And, you know, I did that so many times that like the last company I worked at, for example, Paxos, which used to be called ItBit, they had me teach the developers like three separate times. And that was at that point, it was like, okay, well, obviously, there's a need for some sort of guide or some developer training manual that would be very helpful. And that's essentially what the book is. The other books, Thank God for Bitcoin, Little Bitcoin Book, you know, Bitcoin and the American Dream, and even Fiat Ruins Everything. These are aimed at different audiences. Three of them are aimed to sort of help orange pill people. You know, Little Bitcoin Book is meant for people that don't know anything about it and just they can pick it up. They could read it in one sitting and have a good idea of what Bitcoin is or why it's important. Similar thing for Thank God for Bitcoin and Bitcoin and the American Dream, except one is Thank God for Bitcoin is aimed at Christians and Bitcoin and the American Dream is aimed at politicians / regulators. And, you know, they all sort of have a purpose. And that's how I like to write books is I imagine the audience first and sort of what they need and what sort of review that I'm hoping that they'll write for me when they write a review on Amazon, and then go from there and sort of fill in the blank and afterwards. And that's worked out for me. I've written a bunch of books and they've been pretty successful, I think. So yeah,
very cool. And so you're sort of making the rounds talking about Fiat Ruins Everything now. So maybe let's pivot and talk a little bit about your latest book.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really that new, I guess. It's been almost 2 years since I published it, but it's a book about fiat money and how it has changed the incentives in all kinds of things. And in the book, I go through sort of like what fiat ruins at various different levels. So at the individual level, you know, what does not having a savings vehicle do, and how are we changed by that, and how is society changed by that? And then at the layer above that, it's at the level of companies, and how does fiat money change companies or organizations? And certainly there's a lot about that as well. And then I go up another level to the nation state level and how they operate and what the incentives they have are, and, you know, all the different ways that fiat money ruins their operations and how they do things. And then finally, at the global level, the dollar hegemony that basically rules the world at the moment, you know, how does that change everything? And how does that make the world different than it would be otherwise? So that's what I explore in the book. And, you know, it's a bunch of essays, something like 33 different essays that I wrote over the course of 2 or 3 years. And it's a compilation sort of and made a little bit more cohesive through some of the organization. And yeah, that's what the book is about.
So there's like a, maybe it could be described as an overarching theme around the relationship between sort of money and morality. Is that fair? Like how would you boil this down for someone who's, you know, maybe just now heard that explanation and they're scratching their heads going, like, okay, so.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a moral component to money, and that's something that I've been exploring for quite some time. I think all the books that I've been a part of, Little Bitcoin Book, Thank God for Bitcoin, Bitcoin and the American Dream, and Fiat Ruins Everything, they have a moral component, largely because that's what I found is that's how you can reach people, right? It hits different when, you know, it becomes a moral issue. For a long time, I think in the Bitcoin space, it was all about, you know, making more money, right? Like it was an investment vehicle. It was, you know, like number go up. But by making it a moral argument that the current fiat monetary system is in many ways just evil and causes the wrong incentives and has all kinds of moral hazards, you know, it opens people's eyes, and particularly from like the religious point of view, if you read Thank God for Bitcoin. I've had a lot of people tell me that this is what Orange pilled them, that they weren't interested in Bitcoin at all. And for a lot of people, like, despite, you know, making it seem like everyone is just after a dollar, not everyone is. And there are people that have a higher purpose in life that want to do the right thing. And that's what I argue in a lot of these books, including Fiat Ruins Everything, where we're talking about, like, just how civilization has been collapsing for quite some time now as a result of the weird incentives around fiat money, the corruption and the rot that results.
Yeah, and I think to your earlier point, like, Bitcoin Standard does an exceptional job of laying out the economic case for Bitcoin as a savings tool, but there's still a great case for all kinds of other Bitcoin books for people who just really aren't interested in the history of money or a deep dive into macroeconomics. So I think it's a great way to be able to reach people with something that Bitcoin offers, different people with different motivations.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. And we do have quite a lot of books now, but you have to realize, like, for a lot of people early on, they didn't have any resources at all. So it's reflective of how much the community has grown and how much they're focused on making sure that the newcomers have the right perspective on things. Because as the community has grown, so have all the scams, right? All the altcoins and meme coins and all that stuff. And that's like steering people away from that into, you know, a better grounding of, you know, making civilization better, I think is a better sell, or it's a better way to get them to stick with Bitcoin rather than just be a tourist and get in, get out, and, you know, make some money or something like that, which a lot of people do.
Yeah, I guess some of the arguments that you're talking about in your various books are affirmation of why there could be so many different potential subjects for Bitcoin books now, with all of the different ways that these fiat problems manifest in the real world. So you mentioned altcoins, and this is another sort of we don't do altcoins on the show, but maybe if you could give us a 2-minute rundown around the Bitcoin, your speech for Bitcoin only, and in the context of your book.
Yeah, so there are a couple chapters on altcoins and why they're just sort of very different than Bitcoin. The main reason why they're different is because Bitcoin is decentralized and all these altcoins are centralized, and they're very clearly so in so many ways. You look at something like Ethereum; it's got the Ethereum Foundation, it's got a creator, it has a pre-mine. It has all of these things. But, you know, the altcoiners like to associate themselves with Bitcoin because Bitcoin has done fantastically well since its inception in 2009. It has 16 years of really, like, just no other asset has a history like this, that where it's just going up and to the right, 7 orders of magnitude, right? Like, just, it's like no one's ever seen anything like that before. So by altcoins associating themselves with Bitcoin, by saying that they're like Bitcoin, they're able to get a lot of investment because they're suggesting that they're at an earlier part of the same Bitcoin cycle. Of course, they're not, but they like to conflate the two under the moniker of crypto or digital assets or something like that. But, you know, you look at the history of any of these altcoins and you very quickly realize, like, they peak and then they kind of dump, and then they never sort of get back to its peak, at least in Bitcoin terms. That's been the case with every Bitcoin known to man. Every altcoin known to man is they never get to that because there's something fundamentally different. Despite their conflation of the two, altcoins are extremely different. They're really just kind of centralized secondary fiat money, right? They're more similar to fiat money than Bitcoin. And this is the part that they always kind of leave out, and when they market to you. The fact that XRP is now reaching like $3 or something is like getting people excited. Most of them don't realize that it peaked like that back in 2017. So if you were a holder from then, you're just barely able to exit with a small loss instead of a large one. Like, that's that's how bad these have performed, in part because the people that are in this industry understand what the difference is, despite whatever they say. So the main thing is that they're separate classes of assets, a decentralized digital money versus a centralized digital money. And those are very different things. And they have very different qualities. And, you know, I've written several books on this, so we can go look up exactly what that means. But yeah, that's a big difference.
And the XRP one for me is just an ongoing source of total bewilderment. And I saw a tweet the other day showing that the entire XRP ledger during that 24-hour period had done 44,000 in transactions. And like, you know, Bitcoin is moving like trillions of dollars. And yeah, you just couldn't have a bigger difference of reality to perception as comparing those two things.
Yeah, and that's the thing about altcoins is that they've always been kind of like that. In a sense, like the meme coins that are coming up now are a lot more honest. You know, you know almost immediately that they're all kind of crap, or there's no utility behind it. And they're not faking anything. It's all pump and dump. It's a gambling vehicle and so on. But that's what all altcoins are. And that's the part that a lot of people kind of are missing if they're getting into XRP, is that XRP is closer to meme coin than it is to Bitcoin, right? That's the part that they don't get, or they don't really understand because they haven't, you know, studied it at all. And, you know, probably haven't read any of that stuff. It's just, let's just FOMO into this while things are hot and maybe it'll do something, or, you know, if the SEC drops a lawsuit, it'll move up or whatever. It's no different than gambling or, you know, betting on like an NCAA tournament game or something like that. It's really not. Whereas Bitcoin, it's savings. And that's how, you know, that's who gives it value. It's all the savers. It's the people that are not selling because they're saving for the future. And that makes it much more powerful than all these altcoins, which are essentially tradable gambling vehicles.
Yeah, it's wild. And in spite of that, somehow, I mean, XRP, as a final point, they've just done a very good job of convincing a small number of people that, you know, the global financial system is going to adopt this thing and it'll be worth whatever. And yeah, very different offering.
Yeah.
You've talked a lot about the transition to a world where Bitcoin is sort of a global reserve currency type asset. Maybe not in exactly those words, but love to just talk a little bit about your impression now in 2025 of where you think Bitcoin is headed, sort of in the short term, and your view of where we're going in the long term, and what does that transition look like over the next 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, that predicting the future is always sort of like a difficult thing. What I will say is that much of it is dependent on what the people in the fiat world do, right? At least in the short term, because a lot of that is sort of unpredictable. If you're thinking about like Bitcoin price, for example, there are two components to it. There's supply and demand. We know exactly what the supply is. Like that's obvious because it's enshrined in code, and you're never going to have more than 21 million, and you have an emission schedule that's utterly predictable and very easy to measure. Whereas the dollar part, which is the demand side, we really don't know. Like for a little bit of time in there, we actually had dollar contraction, at least in the M2 money supply, because inflation was going crazy. And, you know, Jerome Powell increased interest rates to the point where no one was borrowing anymore, but, you know, existing loans were being paid back. So you had a slowdown in dollar growth to a point where it like dipped a little bit. But now, you know, like we're having recession fears. So Powell is starting to loosen monetary policy, possibly. I think he kept the rates the same, but, you know, made an announcement about how much of the treasuries that they're going to buy back in the open market operations, and that's reducing. So there's all kinds of like little things like that affect demand for Bitcoin, because if it is expanding, then if the dollar is expanding or there's more dollars, then it's going to be more dollars chasing Bitcoin, and therefore Bitcoin price goes up. But if it contracts, then, you know, there's less demand, then, you know, the price goes down and so on. So now, like over the long term, I think Bitcoin wins, because one of the things that we know about politicians is that they love to spend money. And that requires either like really high revenue of some kind, right? Which means a lot of taxation, or you print money out of thin air, which is another form of taxation, but that's less acknowledged by everybody. So inflation seems to be the way that that things go. So in that case, there's we have fixed supply, increasing demand. We know where the price will go in that respect. Now, like that transition over to a Bitcoin standard from a dollar standard, and I think we're in the middle of it, to be honest. I think a few significant points in the last 5 years. One was, the massive money supply expansion post-COVID. And it was a very interesting monetary expansion because in 2008, they expanded the money supply by more than what, at least as a percentage, than we did in 2020. But the difference between 2008 and 2020 is that in 2008, a lot of the other central banks were buying up the treasuries. In 2020, what you had was these other central banks were no longer buying U.S. treasuries. So all of that money went almost directly to consumer, and it caused grocery stuff to go up, which the previous one didn't really, because a lot of it went to other central banks and rich people. So that was a big sort of like moment in 2020 when the monetary expansion just sort of ended with significant inflation all over the world. It was like 8, 9, 10% in some places that typically have like 2 or 3%. And in places that had like 7 or 8%, they were getting like 20, 30%. So that was a big moment. The other big moment was the Ukraine war. And that was because basically the Western world decided to use economic sanctions in a way that they hadn't before. And that was to cut off Russia from the dollar system, essentially. They seized all the assets and said, okay, we're not going to allow any monetary transactions into Russia, and Russia got off the dollar standard, essentially. They probably have lots of like physical dollar bills in their central bank or something like that, but they're not using dollars. They can't. So that sort of like broke the dam on the dollar hegemony, because it's no longer just a US thing, or it's no longer a world thing. There's a separate group of countries. We call them BRICS, they're sort of like they're the counterpart to the G20, and that means that they, looking for ways to transact without using dollars because of the U.S. hegemony over it. So that seems fairly significant to me in terms of Bitcoin adoption, because once you have two competing world currencies, now you need some way to transact between them, or you need something neutral for anybody that doesn't want to be associated with either one. And Bitcoin seems like it would be an obvious way to sort of sneak in there as that. And, a lot of countries and organizations are adopting Bitcoin as their treasury for, that being part of the reason. But because, the monetary expansion is so clearly felt by everybody that's in the world, right? Like it's no longer just sort of absorbed like a sponge. The sponge is full at this point. You add any more water to it, it's just flowing out. It's going into groceries and things like that. So that's what it seems like to me. It's a long answer to basically tell you that I don't know, but whatever the governments do, it affects it. And over the long term, Bitcoin.
Hey everyone, quick question. Have you ever thought about starting a video podcast like this one? I want to introduce you to the team behind my show, Podigy. This podcast has been one of the best marketing tools for our business. And thanks to Podigy, all I have to do is hit record. They handle everything else, editing, writing, publishing, and making sure that it's perfectly optimized for every platform. They only work with disruptors, mavericks, and change makers. People making a real difference, spreading big ideas. Typically, Podigy is fully booked, but right now they have a few spots open for new clients. Listeners of this show get 10% off launching their own podcast or optimizing their current one. Click the link in the bio for a free one-on-one podcast planning session with Podigy. If you are thinking about starting a podcast, or you have one and you want to take it to the next level, I can't recommend Podigy enough. Check them out. What's your take on the growing number of companies that are using Bitcoin as a treasury asset? Good or bad? And is this something that this is an emerging trend again. So getting back to this, things that you've seen, you know, over your life in Bitcoin, and yeah, how would you assess how that's going?
Yeah, it's interesting because I always thought that, you know, companies would go on the Bitcoin standard, but they would be new companies. I didn't really think about existing companies adopting Bitcoin as a treasury asset, but it kind of makes sense because stocks in many ways are people's store of value. That's their savings, right? If you don't want to get debased by fiat money, by fiat monetary expansion, you store it in something that's going to hold its value. For most normies, that's stocks and real estate. Now, real estate has its own problems and there's overbuilding and things like that going on all over the place. But stocks are, everyone there is looking for yield, right? Like they're looking to keep up with inflation, monetary expansion. So adding Bitcoin to it makes sense for these companies because now it's going to, you have a better treasury asset. It's sort of like a backdoor into Bitcoin. It's the stock market sort of being sanctified by Bitcoin, if you will. It's become, instead of this sort of overpriced fiat asset, it's becoming basically Bitcoinized. And I think that trend continues. Like one more bull cycle, and I think everyone's going to look at MicroStrategy and say, oh my God, why didn't we do this? We better do this for next time. And, you know, we'll see a whole lot more companies come on board with that, because otherwise their stock price is not going to keep up. A lot of companies have like tremendous amounts of cash. I think Apple has like a couple hundred billion dollars in the bank or something like that. And that's a melting ice cube. That's a lot of value that, you know, they're basically losing for their shareholders. At some point, I think that's a giant path to Bitcoinization, and I can see not just like companies, but a lot of countries start doing the same thing. Obviously El Salvador's done that because they don't have their own currency. But you know, a lot of these countries where you start having hyperinflation and so on, if you get U.S. consumer prices going up, like, and the inflation actually hitting, they're going to start looking for other alternatives, and you know, that's where that hyperbitcoinization starts. And gradually, then suddenly, we'll see when the suddenly happens. But I don't know when it's going to be, but it'll be there at some point.
Thinking about your background programming Bitcoin, I'm curious to know your thoughts around Bitcoin's place in sort of the evolving technological world. Thinking specifically about everything that's going on with AI and potentially even quantum computing, or the looming possibility of quantum computing. And how do you think about these things, and with your background as a Bitcoin programmer?
I've been taught, I guess as a programmer, you're taught to be kind of skeptical of like hype. I still remember like back in 98, I came out of college and that I had my first programming job. And it was a software as a service kind of thing before that acronym even existed. And we were selling to different companies. And what we were told was, oh, it's not written in Java and XML. We're not going to buy it. I'm like, why do you care what it's written in? Right? Like, that's not something that as somebody that's, you know, looking at a software product should be thinking about. But that's kind of what had the hype. And Java, Sun Microsystems at the time, I think they've been acquired by Oracle. You know, they did a great job sort of like marketing Java as like this amazing new tool. And they got several schools to, you know, adopt the language and stuff like that. But really, like, it's just a programming language. It's a tool. Why do you care? They started caring because they were marketed that way. And that made me pretty cynical about like a lot of hype technologies. And even back then, supposedly quantum computing was a thing, and it's always perpetually 10 years away, 20 years away from doing something actually useful. My gut feeling on quantum computing is that it's similar to climate change. It's something that's always used to sort of scare people, but you know, it doesn't actually have any real stuff behind it. I actually studied some of it. And if you understand how it works, you understand, okay, well, so all this stuff has to be coherent. And, you know, like assuming that, you know, everything is sort of locked in this perpetual state, you can make one observation and then everything else sort of like goes to a fixed state. That's just how quantum mechanics works. So that gives you an advantage, maybe like square roots the time required on certain things. And we have this entire industry of academic papers that assume that a quantum computer can be built in a particular way. And based on that, they make all these algorithms and assumptions and possible cracking of different things. And then I look at the actual physical reality and it's like, no, that's not going to happen. It's just really difficult. And there's like four or five really difficult engineering problems that like they don't know how to do at all. So I don't see quantum as a threat. I get that it gets a lot of hype. If you're Google and you have a whole quantum computing division, you have to put out press releases every once in a while, or like your shareholders are going to get mad that you're spending so much money on it. And, you know, that's true of all the other quantum computing labs as well. But honestly, I haven't seen anything that's actually progressing beyond, you know, like generating random numbers, which any quantum thing should be able to do very easily. AI, that's slightly different. I don't know if there's quite the intersection that quantum has, because at least in theory, quantum can break some of the cryptography that Bitcoin is based on. But like AI, it's another tool. It seems like, as far as I can understand it from a technical perspective, it's just a really good guessing engine at the next word, or the next pixel, or the next voice or whatever. And that has its uses. And I use it every day to do various things, especially like around searching or research or whatever. But you know, it doesn't necessarily have like that much of a connection to Bitcoin. I don't know. I don't necessarily think so. I do think that it's very powerful for people that are already pretty motivated. For the people that are not, that which I think is the vast majority of people in a fiat world, whether they're drugged up on sugar or alcohol or video games or porn or whatever, they don't really care about that, right? They're not interested in being productive. I don't think it's very useful. But for the 20% that are productive, that do things and make things, I think it's a useful tool, and it'll probably increase their productivity at least by 50-100%, maybe even more than that. It's one of those things that makes for great demos, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it like penetrates every industry in the way that you think. There are like hundreds of AI startups at this point. Most of them have no idea what they're doing, or trying to make a market where there isn't one, or replacing a service that's already pretty cheap, stuff like that. So yeah, I don't know where that necessarily fits in. So, but you know, I will grant that it's very useful. So yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I've seen you make some bearish statements around, sort of like the output of AI, the marginal cost trending to zero and really sort of creating very little economic reward over time.
At least for the AI companies. I mean, it's very useful to programmers like me. And I'm paying for Grok right now, which is like $15 a month or something. I certainly think that's worth more than a Netflix subscription. But you know, like, does everybody? Not really. I mean, if you're working on stuff, I mean, if you're some guy collecting unemployment, like, why do you care about that, right? Or if you're DEI officer at some Fortune 500 company, like why do you care about that? Like, that's not going to make your life any better. So it's like a productivity multiplier for people that are motivated. But like, as far as like the actual companies and sort of what the VC investment has put in, I mean, it's like, it's a race to the bottom. There's already open source models that do like 80% of what Grok or OpenAI does. At some point, right now, the big cost to run some of these models is you need like hardware to be able to process all that, to get it in like a reasonably fast answers to the questions you have or the things that you want to generate. So, I mean, that will come down over time. It's which is why like the biggest beneficiary of this whole AI boom is NVIDIA, right? Like they're the hardware makers, they're the shovel sellers instead of like the gold miners or whatever, and they make the most money. So yeah, it's an interesting area. I do use it, and I think there's definitely something in it that will change things in the future. I don't know. Maybe you get more movies because you can AI generate a lot of the special effects or whatever, instead of like these very expensive special effects studios that do all of that stuff. Who knows? But yeah, I mean, much of it is not quite like as powerful, I think, as people make it out to be. And, you know, technologists have a tendency to overhype a lot of the things that they see. The only one where I feel like that's warranted is Bitcoin. All the other stuff is, it's just sort of like, okay, well, let's see. Let's see how it impacts stuff.
Maybe just to switch gears for a final thought, I would come back to your book and ask you a question. You're a father and a family man. And if we could sort of single out sort of one subsection of how fiat ruins things, your 3-5 minute take on the disastrous impacts of fiat money on the family and the home.
Yeah, I mean, the main way in which fiat has debased family is by providing services to everybody, right? And that sounds good in theory, right? The great society programs, right? Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Equivalent things all over the world. It sounds good in theory, but what it's actually doing is undermining family and community. It's undermining the bonds that you're supposed to have with people that are close to you. Instead, it's replaced by a faceless government that gives you stuff for free or gives you stuff based on your compliance. And that is the basis of a lot of things. So it used to be that your family was where you got pretty much everything, right? Like that was what you invested in the most. Now it's not so much anymore. Whatever political identity you have, you get a lot of stuff from the government instead. And that's what's kind of replaced it. So as a result, we have looser bonds and sometimes no bonds at all. Very, very few communities really feel like communities anymore. I think particularly after COVID, like people didn't even want to know their neighbors because you might get COVID or something. Like it became sort of like this very isolating thing. And that's endemic of fiat money, is that it's when something's provided, when you don't need each other, you stop relating. And that's unfortunately what's happened. So as a result, what you get are people that aren't even getting married, right? Like certainly aren't having children, and aren't even thinking about like what life is going to be when they're older, because of course you have Social Security, Medicare, and all that stuff. Instead of investing in your children, who will hopefully take care of you later and, you know, be a warm and loving presence in your life as you age, instead you go with, you know, cold, faceless government program that will give you a check and pretend that the money makes up for all of the relational needs that you have, which obviously isn't, but that's sort of like the lie of fiat money, is that money makes up for anything, right? Like it's, yeah, if you sue somebody for something, it's always like a monetary compensation, even if it's like emotional distress or suffering or whatever. And that's a lie that we've been told, is that money makes up for all of that. And it doesn't. And putting money in its right place is a part of becoming mature, which I think a lot of people in the fiat world just never get to, just because money solves a lot of their problems, like in a debased way, but it does to some degree. You might not get married, but maybe you, get an OnlyFans subscription and now you sort of have a relationship with somebody that's on the other side. Probably not the actual person, but some other person that's upselling you or something, right? Like that seems to be the direction that fiat money has brought us to, is that money replaces pretty much anything that you find valuable, because, you know, you can put a price tag on anything. And that's just simply not true. I think human experience teaches us this, and you can, there's a lot of miserable billionaires out there. Learning about that and figuring out how to live life is in a way that is actually fulfilling, that is meaningful, I think is the thing that a lot of Bitcoiners pursue, and which is why so many of them are getting married, are having kids, are going to church again, things like that. And that's a great thing.
Beautifully said. Jimmy, thanks so much for coming on the show. This has been a real treat for our listeners who are, this is your first, their first exposure to you. Is there anywhere in particular we can send them? Obviously, your books are available on Amazon, but...
Yeah, you can look on X at Jimmy Song. I have my newsletter, jimmysong.substack.com, and it's somewhat technical, at least for the paid subscribers, but I also put in a bunch of stuff that I find interesting, articles that I read and stuff like that that aren't necessarily related to Bitcoin, although I always try to make comments on how I think it's related. And all the appearances, podcasts, and stuff like that, including this show, will probably be in there. JimmySong.substack.com.
Very cool. Well, thank you again. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in. And we hope to see you again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits, supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.